This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Lynn Neary.
I'm Robert Siegel, and it's time now for our weekly talk on politics. And joining me are our regular political observers, columnists E.J. Dionne of The Washington Post and the Brookings Institution, and David Brooks of The New York Times. Hello to both of you.
Good to be with you.
We'll begin with the speech that President Obama delivered on Tuesday in Osawatomie, Kansas, the site of a famous speech by Theodore Roosevelt just over a century ago. And the president cited some of T.R.'s themes.
I believe that this country succeeds when everyone gets a fair shot, when everyone does their fair share, when everyone plays by the same rules.
One could say when everyone gets a square deal. E.J., in your column about that speech, you called it the inaugural address that Obama never gave. First, what's so important about what he said, and isn't it kind of late for an inaugural keynote?
Well, it would have been nicer earlier, but a lot of us say there's a modest fan club for T.R.'s Osawatomie speech, and so the loyalists are glad Obama brought this to everyone's attention. And I think the reason why it was like an inaugural address is he offered a clear philosophical rationale for his presidency, why he thinks government has an important role. He offered a narrative explaining the causes of our travails, and he also laid out a battle plan against radicalized conservatism. And he and T.R. have something very much in common, which is Obama has been criticized for being both too close to Wall Street and for being a socialist from the right. T.R. in his original speech said, "Here in Kansas, there is one paper which habitually denounces me as the tool of Wall Street and at the same time frantically repudiates the statement that I am a socialist on the ground that this is an unwarranted slander of socialists." And I think that Obama must have chuckled when he read that.
David, by linking his speech to Teddy Roosevelt, the president could say that redressing economic inequalities or the privileges of the rich aren't some kind of alien class warfare. It's in the American tradition. In fact, of both parties, it's in the American tradition. You think he's right?
Yeah. Well, sort of. There's early Roosevelt and there's late Roosevelt. Early Roosevelt believed in making competition fair in the square deal. Late Roosevelt, progressive Roosevelt, put a lot of faith in experts and centralizing power. I like the early one. I think E.J. has a little more taste for the later. I thought there was a lot to like in the speech. I guess I have two criticisms of it. First, I think this election is going to be about national decline. It's not going to be, as the president tried to make it, an election about inequality. And so he can focus on greedy bankers and CEOs, and a lot of us will nod our heads. Nonetheless, the core issue is economic growth and job creation, and I think he's sidestepping the core issue. The second is just a matter of substance. The only policy I could see in there was the idea of raising taxes on the rich to pay for more infrastructure spending and more basic research, which I'm for, but is he really going to run for president on that? It's an extremely modest agenda given the broad problems he described.
EJ?
I agree with David that this election is about national decline, and I disagree with him on everything else, because I think if this speech was actually about more than higher taxes on the rich, it was very much about how do you expand opportunity for the middle class, why we need regulation to make capitalism work in a fair way. And I think it was forward looking. I think what Obama was saying is we need to take these steps so that we don't go into decline, so that we get our act back together again.
By the way, EJ, are you confident that this is the tone now for the campaign, or might President Obama, you know, reconfigure it, retriangulate it at some point between now and November?
Well, if you look at the history of the administration, you always wonder, are they going to retriangulate it? I talked to somebody in the White House who made a good point. He said, look, defending the progressive tradition in America is not a problem because, unlike a rather rigid conservatism, progressivism, liberalism, is rather pragmatic and is willing to adjust to circumstances. So I think he thinks this is a message that works for liberals, and there were a lot of cheers from liberals this week, but also can work with middle-of-the-road voters.
Well, the other political man of the week is clearly Newt Gingrich. The former Speaker of the House has emerged as the latest challenger to Mitt Romney. And he's reminded us that he is still capable of tossing red meat to his critics. For example, opining here on poor elementary school students and proposing a kind of work-study program for 10-year-olds.
What if you paid them part-time in the afternoon to sit at the clerical office and greet people when they came in? What if you paid them to work as the assistant librarian? What if and I'd pay them as early as is reasonable and practical.
David Brooks, you devoted a column to Newt Gingrich today, very critical of his candidacy, despite your feeling some real philosophical kinship with him. What is Newt's problem?
character. He is the real Teddy Roosevelt candidate, or is in his best moments, wanting to use government to enhance growth and competition. His problem is he can't believe the same thing for 5 seconds in a row. Every moment in his life has no bearing on the next moment. And any word he says has no bearing on the moment after that. As I was listening to that clip, I was reminded that when he was speaker, he would have a press person on his staff in front of him, nodding his head when Newt was being good and shaking his head when Newt was straying off into some strange idea. And so you need that. And it's very interesting. Peggy Noonan made a very good point in her column in The Wall Street Journal today that the people around Mitt Romney generally want him to be president. The people who worked with Newt Gingrich generally are desperately afraid that he might become president because he is inconsistent and erratic.
You had a great line about the 1950s and 60s that I want you to repeat.
Yeah, that's what we're facing, a candidacy on the Republican side between Mitt Romney, who looked like he walked straight out of the 1950s with his G. Willikers vocabulary, and Newt Gingrich, who walked straight out of the 1960s wanting to turn everything into a revolution.
EJ?
I think an awful lot of conservatives in Washington are petrified at the prospect of a Gingrich candidacy. I've been surprised at how many of them I've run into in the last week of a Gingrich presidency. You know, Ed Schultz at MSNBC said he's like a blender with the top off. And another prominent Republican I know said there was a big file drawer in Newt's office. Four of the drawers were marked Newt's ideas. One of them was marked Newt's good ideas. And I think there's a sense that this man can be very creative, but a lot of people just can't see him as president.
But isn't David Brooks, isn't there a real gap here between the reasoned opinions of establishment Republicans, conservative and otherwise, and what turns on grassroots Republican activists? They seem to be very pro-Newt at this moment.
Right, because he can take it to the opposition as hard as possible. And it's very interesting to watch the people who were served in Congress with him on the Republican side wondering if they should come out and endorse Romney or criticize Newt. And they have a suspicion it wouldn't make any difference. And that could be right. So they're really hanging back, but they're scared.
The more the establishment in Washington attacks him, the stronger he might get, and that's the box they're in.
You mean that they could manage to turn Newt Gingrich into the anti-Washington
candidate? Yes, the former Speaker of the House of Representatives, who spent years here in Washington, is going to become the outsider. Politics is amazing.
EJ Dionne and David Brooks, thanks for talking with us once again.
Thank you.
Have a great weekend.
It's NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Lynn Neary.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The shopping mall is in trouble. That fixture of the suburban landscape has been hit hard by the recession. Even as business picks up, malls must compete with the rush to shop online. NPR's Larry Abramson takes us to one shopping mall that's trying to escape the dustbin of retail history.
If you want to get to the White Flint Mall in the Maryland suburbs near Washington, D.C., you have to sail through a sea of parking spaces. The stores are surrounded by acres of asphalt that sit empty for much of the year.
They're parked for Black Friday, basically. The only day they're busy, or fully full.
For Roland Stanley, this mall's dependence on cars is the reason it needs radical surgery. Stanley is the chief planner for Montgomery County. If he has his way, someday people will live and work right where we are driving. All that wasted parking will be turned into residential and office space. The parking will go underground. It's all part of an effort to find a way out of the gridlock created by suburban sprawl. Inside the mall, the kids' choo-choo is a reminder of busier times when this might have been a cool place to take the family. White Flint is not dying, but its glory days are past. Developers have tried numerous redesigns, but shoppers and retailers prefer hipper locations not far from here. Standing in the center of White Flint, Roland Stanley says we need to transform this space without destroying it.
The White Flint Mall will be like Transformers. You know, things will come off of it, but the nucleus of the transformer will be there, and all of a sudden it won't be a car anymore. It's going to be this strong retailing base with all these mixed uses above it. So this will be the transformer version of the retail industry.
That's visionary speak for saying that this enclosed space will turn into an outdoor square, a piazza, surrounded by new stores and restaurants. the familiar anchors of the current mall, Bloomingdale's and Lord & Taylor, will remain standing. So the Mall of the Future will be an amalgam of America's urban and its suburban past. The new stores may be smaller.
I can show you Best Buys in other cities that are like 10,000 square feet. They're almost like pickup outlets where you go and get your product. That's going to happen more and more. It's already changing the face of retailing.
Stanley says that smaller scale and the outdoor design will attract the demographic that this county needs most, young people.
It's an expensive place to live. We're not attracting young people. We're one of the fastest aging counties in the country, and our property tax base has really plummeted through this recession.
In reimagining this mall, developers and planners are anticipating another trend, the rise of online shopping. Sucharita Molpuru of Forrester Research says malls are not disappearing, but the Internet is making competition much tougher, and only the best designed shopping centers will survive.
If you want somebody to go to an Ann Taylor or a J. Crew, you know, you need to make it convenient and easy for them. And because one of the main reasons that people choose to shop online is that they don't want to have to fight the crowd. They don't want to have to deal with parking.
And that brings us to the other reason why redeveloping malls like White Flint is such a mammoth task. These places are like suns in their own solar system. They're surrounded by all kinds of strip malls and clogged roads. The county is planning to spend around two decades upgrading all that stuff with a focus on better mass transit. The goal may sound paradoxical, but county planner Roland Stanley says more density is the answer to traffic problems.
More strategically located density, near our transit stops.
White Flint has a metro stop that's half an hour ride from downtown Washington. Still, there is worry that such a massive redesign of this area will add to congestion. Neighbors of White Flint, like longtime resident Paul Meyer, are supportive of the plan, but he says there's a lot here that can go wrong.
If the construction is done and you increase the retail space, the commercial space, and the residential space, and you don't do anything about traffic, walking, etc., you'll have a real problem. You'll have a nightmare, basically. It's a nightmare now. It'll get worse.
But Meyer supports the basic concept, and he looks forward to the day when life in these suburbs is more like where he grew up, New York City. Now, you don't have to drive far to find once carefully planned experiments that are now dinosaurs. So the risks in these projects are high. If people don't like the Mall of the Future, they can easily decide to shop from home. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Anita Desai's new collection of stories, The Artist of Disappearance, reads a bit like three symphonic movements in a minor key. They're three novellas set in modern India, in which the past is giving way. In one story, a government official inspects the forgotten treasures left behind in a faded mansion till he finds a huge treasure living on borrowed time. In another story, a translator becomes a little too creative. And in the third, a man living in solitude finds his world upset by roving visitors. There are no car chases or explosions, but the drama of people confronting themselves. Anita Desai, who's written more than a dozen novels and collections and has been shortlisted three times for the Booker Prize, joins us from New York. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for asking me.
The first story, Museum of Final Journeys. There's a civil servant who's called in to appraise an old collection of antiquities, and there are, with some exceptions, not works of art per se. They're globes and travel posters and stuffed birds and lizards and masks and daggers and scrolls and bells and clocks long broken. And he calls it, wrote down this wonderful phrase, this gloomy storehouse of abandoned, disused, decaying objects I wanted only to break free and flee. Is there a theme in there about the different ways people have of looking at the past?
To tell you the truth, I thought of that story all in about 5 minutes when I was walking through a museum that was just like it, the Museum of Oriental Art in Venice. Mm-hmm. Apparently an Italian aristocrat had set out and traveled in the East and sent back all these treasures. And yet, having been removed from where they belonged, where they'd been made, they had lost the quality of life. They all were just objects shut up in glass cases, which made me wonder, what makes people collect such objects? What can it mean to anyone? So I was also thinking about the pointlessness of it all, the futility of trying to recreate other countries, other histories, other paths.
Your second story, a teacher, a professor named Purma Joshi, translates a novel from an Indian language, and she kind of likes the power that she enjoys. She finishes a session of translation, and it makes her sort of see the world differently when she walks back out into the street. What changed her?
Well, this is a story based very much on the translators I have known myself and heard other writers talk of. And I realized that all translators, they all long to be writers and themselves. If they didn't have that longing, they probably wouldn't be very good translators. But a lot of them do have that creative urge. And my character, Prema Joshi, simply gets carried away with that.
This inevitably raises the question as to whether you've ever encountered one of your works being translated by a translator who, in your mind, took too many liberties.
I can't quote from my own experience, but I know my daughter being told that a very, very funny book that she wrote, her very first book, the kind of book which makes you laugh out loud, when it was translated into some of the Scandinavian languages, didn't make anyone laugh at all. There was no humor left in it whatsoever.
You mentioned your daughter, who, of course, is Kiran Desai, an accomplished novelist and Booker Prize winner. What did you tell her about writing, looking back on it?
I didn't dare tell her anything. All my children told me they never wanted to become writers. They said, "You lead such a boring life, we don't want to live the way you do." And even Kiran just fought against the idea of writing. I used to tell her, "She writes such wonderful letters, why doesn't she do more with that?" And she would always say no. But she went to a very good college, and the professors there encouraged her to write. Like me, they saw she had that spark in her. This was what she should really have been doing. Now, of course, we both write in the same house, and it's wonderful to be able to talk about our work, about each other's work, about the books we're reading.
Oh, what a blessing that is for a mother and daughter to be able to do that.
Oh, yes, it is.
Let me ask you about the final story in this collection. It's the title story, The Artist of Disappearance. You have a character, Ravi, who is living what we would call a hermit-like existence. He's been working on a kind of splendid rock sculpture hidden in the Himalayan foothills, and then a movie crew from Delhi comes to visit. And they see things differently, I think it's safe to say. What's the difference between Ravi and the people, the film people?
I think Ravi, as you say, is something of a hermit, and he's never really entered the adult world. And he retains that child's point of view. He never thinks of himself as an artist. He has no desire to reveal it to the outer world. He simply doesn't have those adult impulses or ambitions. The television crew that comes up from Delhi, of course, is totally different. They belong to two different worlds.
Well, for me, this story raised the question, is there art without an audience?
I think the audience is quite certain that there isn't, that the art only becomes art once it is looked upon as such. But in my experience, there are artists who have done things entirely for themselves, and the audience is unimportant and often destructive to their vision. But all of us who've ever written, composed music, painted, know that when we perform these acts, we are not in touch with the world. We are completely withdrawn from it, and in our own worlds, we are recreating an inner world.
Mr. Desai, awfully good speaking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you for asking me.
Anita Desai, her new book of three novellas is The Artist of Disappearance. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Diplomats at the United Nations climate talks in Durban, South Africa, are still struggling to bring that meeting to some sort of close. Still no deal from the talks, which are supposed to coordinate international efforts on global warming. Diplomats are hoping that all the talk won't prove to be just a lot of carbon emissions. We're joined now from the talks by NPR's Richard Harris. Richard, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Scott.
Durban's a beautiful place to be, and saying goodbye is a hard thing for all of us. But what's holding up the talks?
Good question. Well, I'm in the basement of the conference center, so it's not quite as beautiful down here. But in the biggest sense, this has never been an easy topic because climate change really touches on some of the biggest and most difficult issues out there. Developing nations put their economic growth first, which is understandable. Rich nations are worried about economic competitiveness. Then, of course, are the oil-rich nations, which worry about their future economies. And let's not forget the island nations who worry about disappearing under the waves as sea level rises. So that's the big picture. More specifically, here in Durban, the biggest disagreement is really what to do during the coming decade in order to ramp up efforts on climate change.
Wasn't there a deal just 2 years ago in Copenhagen?
There was, and it was a voluntary agreement. It had some very strong language, and the really good news about that is it brought all the world's biggest emitters together, the United States and China, and they've all pledged to take steps to slow their carbon emissions, so that's good. The bad news is that those pledges don't add up enough to prevent the planet from heating up quite rapidly. So there's been a lot of pressure at this meeting to find a way to step up the ambition and speed things up, and really a lot of disagreement about what that different deal should look like.
What are the prospects, as you see it, for some kind of compromise?
It's hard to say right now. I just came from upstairs where ministers are huddled in a meeting trying to work something out. What they are really working on is language that's loose enough and ambiguous enough to satisfy everyone, particularly countries like the United States, China, and India, who are still thinking about those big pledges they made in Copenhagen and saying, you know, can we actually do more than that? And they are, on the other hand, the weaker the language gets, if you make, you know, the lowest common denominator kind of language, then draws objections from more ambitious branches of folks here, including the European Union and, of course, many of the world's poorest countries.
Yeah. And of course, we've been hearing that this is all tied up with the future of the Kyoto Climate Treaty. How does that play into events?
Well, let me remind you, the Kyoto Treaty now only pertains to Europe and a handful of other countries, and their initial promises to reduce emissions actually sunset at the end of next year. So the treaty really has no long-term future. It does not include the world's biggest emitters, us and China and India and so on. Mm-hmm. But the developing world still loves it because it explicitly says that they don't have to take any action to combat climate change unless the rich nations pay them to do so. So Europe is still willing to extend its commitment under the Kyoto Treaty, but they're trying to use that as leverage, essentially, to bring about a new deal here that includes everybody. I'm not sure if the ambiguous lingual language we've been hearing about is enough to satisfy Europe's position about that, and they have very ambitious goals of their own for trying to reduce climate change. They want to get everyone else on board on there. So really what we're seeing here in part is the fate of the Kyoto Treaty is hanging in the balance.
And Richard, what happens if there's no agreement?
Well, in the short run, that would be an embarrassment for the host country. The Kyoto Protocol in particular is loved on this continent, and South Africans don't want to have it die on African soil. Mm-hmm. And other people don't want to put them in that position either. So that's there. It's possible the conference will adopt some important but more technical decisions, and it's also possible that a lot of this will just get kicked down the road for 6 months or a year till the next meeting.
Well, and we hope you'll be there. NPR's Richard Harris at the UN Climate Talks in Durban. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Time now for sports. Money talks. Big stars walk, fly, even, in Major League Baseball. A canceled, then reinstated, and now reevaluated trade shakes up basketball before it can even start up again. We're joined now by NPR's eminent sports correspondent, Tom Goldman, reporting from State College, Pennsylvania. Tom, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure, Scott.
Let's begin by following the money. The Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim, Pasadena, and Cucamonga have just signed Albert Pujols for $260 million over 10 years, a no-trade contract. Of course, he helped the St. Louis Cardinals to two world championships. One of the great players of history. But do you still sign an athlete in his 30s for 10 years?
Yeah, you know, because I think a guy like Pujols, probably they figure, you know, he's good for maybe another six or seven. I think the critics are saying, wow, look at the end of that 10-year career, and maybe it won't seem like such a good thing. But I think, you know, for the next maybe half dozen years, it should pay off handsomely for the Angels, as should the acquisition of C.J. Wilson, the great pitcher for Texas, who's now also an L.A. Angel. So, you know, out of nowhere, seemingly, over $300 million combining for two players. You know, I should say that the Angels, and really since 2004, have been one of the biggest spenders in the league, but this year was a particularly huge splash.
Let me turn to the NBA, because there was supposed to be peace on Christmas Day when the season is scheduled to renew, but Thursday, Commissioner David Stern vetoed a three-team trade that would have sent Chris Paul to the L.A. Lakers from the New Orleans Hornets. The NBA operates the Hornets until they can find a new owner. The commissioner said letting Chris Paul play in L.A., where he wants to, wouldn't be in the best interest of the game. Now he's pulled back on that a bit. It seems to be rethinking a controversial deal. Does this remind players why they have a union?
Yeah, I think so. You know, there just was a lot of angry stuff being said about, you know, David Stern trying to control things too much, which he has done in the past, from the length of players' shorts to how they should wear their headbands. But yeah, and there was a lot of consternation. But as you say, we maybe have to hold off on all that evil David Stern talk, because apparently the NBA has given the Hornets the okay to reconsider the trade. Apparently the league wants more young players or draft picks going to the Hornets as part of the deal, which brought them three, you know, solid starting players. So it still may be on.
And while we're talking about the NBA, is this the end of the road for Portland Trailblazer Brandon Roy?
It seems to be a very sad story. You know, early this morning, the Blazers released a statement in which Roy said, after consulting with my doctors, I will seek a determination that I've suffered a career-ending injury. He's only 27, Scott, but there's no cartilage between the bones in both knees, and one physician reportedly told him if he kept playing, he might end up not being able to walk. He's been one of the NBA's brightest stars in recent years, a three-time All-Star, 2007 Rookie of the Year, and he was really the face of a Portland franchise that turned around its fortunes. It was known for a lot of years, as you know, as the Jailblazers, and he was a very likable guy, loved in Portland, and he was the face of that team.
Tom Kircher in State College following the case of sexual abuse charges against the former Penn State coach Jerry Sandusky. He's set to appear in court early next week, facing more than 50 charges of sexual abuse. What kind of case does the Pennsylvania Attorney General seem to be building against it?
You know, Scott, the old saying, where there's smoke, there's fire. We've had some people tell us that. Of course, Sandusky, you know, proclaims his innocence. His lawyer has been very aggressive in trotting him out there and you know, having very highly publicized interviews saying he's innocent. You know, the Pennsylvania Attorney General thinks they have a good case. We'll find out more about, you know, what kind of evidence they have at the preliminary hearing on Tuesday.
NPR's Tom Goldman in State College, Pennsylvania. Thanks so much.
You bet.
Word came this week that scientists at the University of California, Berkeley, have found the two largest black holes known to exist. Each is 10 billion times the size of our sun and more than 300 million light years away. Now, we should explain, black holes are thought to hold some of the mysteries of our universe. They are so dense, they have so much gravitational pull, that not even light can escape. That makes this discovery all the more remarkable. Chengpei Ma is a professor of astronomy at UC Berkeley, and she led the team that published the research, which appears this week in the journal Nature. She joins us on the phone. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
So how inadequate was my explanation of black holes? And
no, that was beautiful. That was exactly what I was going to say, and I have nothing more to add.
Well.
We're finished.
I like having you on this program, Doctor. Well, let me ask. Now, I understand the previous black hole record holder was only six times the size of our sun. So what makes the ones just discovered so large?
Yes. How did these monsters get so big? What did they eat? I mean, somebody was feeding them. And we believe in their youth, they probably gobbled up lots of gas that was available to them in their parent galaxy. And they got really big, and today they live in very quiet galaxies in retirement without much gas. So they were kind of hard to find.
That raises this question. How do you find something that is invisible and 300 million light years away in any case.
That's right.
And if you say, with great difficulty, I'm going to be very unsatisfied. Yes.
But by definition, as you said, black holes can't be seen. So we had to use stars very close to the black holes so that they are feeling the very strong gravity from the holes. The faster they're moving indicates the stronger the gravity it is. Therefore, the more massive the black hole. We needed to observe the motions of the stars within about 1,000 light years of the black hole. However, this is 1,000 light years at a distance of 300 million light years. So analogy will be, this is like squinting at Yo-Yo Ma playing the cello in New York's Carnegie Hall from Washington, D.C., and then you're trying to measure how fast his fingers were moving while playing the fly of the bumblebee.
That's hard. Now, these black holes sound so enormous and powerful. Are they anywhere near us? Any reason to worry that they'll be hungry for us too?
There is actually a very good evidence for a black hole in our own galaxy. Still, don't worry. Our own black hole is about 25,000 light years from us, so I wouldn't get too close, but our solar system is safe so far.
Professor, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Chengpei Ma, professor of astronomy at UC Berkeley. Yo-Yo Ma, Bobby McFerrin. You're listening to NPR News.